This week, for some of you that have been, the other two talks, I've been talking about Marxist humanism. And the theologian I'm going to mainly talk about today, who is a man by the name of Junger Moltmann, not Boltmann, but Moltmann, M-O-L-T-M-A-N-N, is a evangelical theologian, but has to a great extent been influenced by this kind of Marxist humanism and the Christian Marxist dialogue, and particularly by a Marxist philosopher by the name of Ernst Bloch, whose works are just now being translated into English. Herder and Herder is doing a big, massive translation of his Principles of Hope. And I think a lot of Moltmann's structure of thought is influenced by Bloch, without quite as much admission of this as I think he should have given. Anyway, I want to start out by talking about why it is that Christianity in this era of the late 1960s suddenly has got involved in talking about the theology of hope, and this has become a kind of a big theme in the late 1960s. That sort of became the new theme for theology, which was supposedly superseding secular and death of God theology and so on, and pointing to a reemergence of questions about God and about history. And then, of course, there's a whole kind of new school in Germany with people like Pannenberg and Ott and so on, who are interested in sort of a new understanding of the relationship between Christianity and history. To a large extent, revolting against the rather unhistorical treatment of theology in the existentialists. I mean, the existentialists talked all the time about history, but in fact their way of using history was very unhistorical. They used history really to mean the conditions of historicity, kind of in a kind of a punctual moment of time, you know, and they had no real sense of the meaningfulness of history as a continuity. And I think that's the theme that is emerging in the new theologians of history in Germany in the 1960s. Now, this kind of sequence, you know, kind of Time Magazine-type sequence of secular theology, death of God, and then theology of hope, in some ways was a kind of a media sequence. I mean, that's the way Time Magazine or whatever, popular media, happened to pick it up. But I think there is a kind of deeper sequence here that does have something more to it than merely the way Time Magazine happened to pick up, you know, about 6 years later, what was going on. I think that this kind of sequence from secular and death of God theology to theology of hope does point to a kind of deeper crisis within theology and perhaps within sort of Western culture, which the theology of hope was trying to overcome. Now, if you know something about the history of modern theology, you know that crisis theology, as it was developed by Barth, the theology of the word and so forth in Barth, and then moved on into what was called kerygmatic theology, that this theology, to a large extent, rose as a polemic against the old liberalism. And the old 19th century liberalism was to, they felt, was a kind of a, what they called cultural Protestantism, a kind of Christianity that tended just to bless the existing social order and so forth. But this kind of theology, the old liberal theology, was of course also founded in a kind of faith in human progress. It was a kind of optimistic belief in man's potential and so forth. In other words, 19th century concepts of progress had, so to speak, secularized Christian future hope. and believed that Christian future hope was something that was being realized within history, that we were sort of on our way to the kingdom of God. This was the kind of thinking you got in the social gospel and so on. Now, crisis theology arose as a critique of this kind of liberal progressivism. It stood against the naive optimism of it, and of course stood against it in the light of the First World War, and even more profoundly in the light of Nazism and so on. So it took its stand against the naive optimism of the 19th century, its lack of a sense of radical evil, its lack of a real sense of sin in liberal theology, and its tendency to sanctify or deify modern cultural trends. You get this kind of thing in Niebuhr, for example, in America, and so on. Crisis theology then took its stand on an insistence on the radical transcendency of God and also the radical transcendency of the kingdom of God, and insisted on the finiteness of man over against this radical transcendency of God and the kingdom. These two then, so to speak, represent the transcendent poles over against finite man. And they have the effect of relativizing all of man's human projects, that man is sort of put down in his place, so to speak, and prevented from being this heaven stormer who is always trying to make himself into God. But the transcendent kingdom is also the power and the transcendent God, and there's almost a kind of fusion of these two things. This is also the thing that keeps man kind of moving, opening him up to new possibilities, preventing him from sort of staying where he is. So crisis theology did use the concept of the future as a key concept. If you read Bultmann and Gilgarten and so forth, you'll discover that the idea of the future is an important theological category. But it's not a future in the sense that there's going to be some final goal that will finally arrive, but rather it is a future in the sense of sort of endless crisis, endless opening up to new possibilities. And so the life of the Christian that sort of suggested in people like Bultmann is a life of faith. A life of faith that's really defined in terms of an ability to live in radical insecurity, to be constantly able to sort of leave behind the little Egypts of your past and go out again and again into a new desert. But somehow or other, this thing just sort of keeps on and on, and the idea that you're going to somehow arrive at that promised land is cut off, because that promised land is a kind of transcendency which finite man can never achieve. So the kingdom of God becomes a kind of power which constantly pulls man out of his insecurities into new possibilities. The idea that you're going to finally get there into some kind of completed synthesis of the kingdom with historical reality, that I think was either openly or latently rejected. And so really the idea of heaven as a final thing that was going to be achieved was rejected by crisis theology, and instead the idea of heaven or the kingdom was used as a power to create crisis within man's present situation and to open him up to constant new possibilities. Now, I think that this kind of idea was very exciting at first, when it was operating over against the sort of naive liberalism of the past. But as this kind of theology moved on, of course, in the cultural context of the 20th century, the idea of the kingdom of God simply as a source of crisis, but never as a literal promise of fulfillment, I think tended to erode the nerve of social expectation. And here I think the theology was not so much the leader as simply kind of the reflector, perhaps, of the erosion of optimism in Western society generally. When Barthes and these people were thundering against 19th century optimism in 1920, this might seem very prophetic, but after the First World War and after Nazism and after the concentration camps and after the bomb and after all of this, to be still thundering against optimism in 1967 is kind of like kicking somebody who's been down for the third time, you see. I mean, somehow that kind of prophetism is no longer maybe what we need today, but rather we need some kind of rebirth in faith that perhaps we can do something right after all, you see. I think there was a tendency in the sort of Niebuhrian realism, the insistence on confining man to his finite possibilities and so on, that tends to cut the nerve of this more daring type of expectation, and therefore to move from a sort of criticism on the left more and more to a rather complacent satisfaction with the status quo. And that's why Niebuhr, the Marxist of the 1930s, sort of gives birth to disciples who are right-wing Republicans defending the Vietnamese War. In other words, when you sort of lose that crazy faith in the impossible possibility of a real kingdom of God in history, when in some sense you cannot still affirm that even against all realism, something of the nerve of man's faith in his ability to change his situation also fades away. So I think that out of this kind of erosion of optimism in modern society, the kind of critique which crisis theology made in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s ceased to be so appropriate, and instead there came a demand to re-examine the basis of hope, the basis of man's hope. So I think that this is the reason why you find in the 1960s a kind of turning back to recover some of those themes of the earlier theology. There becomes a new interest in Hegelianism, kind of neo-Hegelianism, turning back to that tradition of progress, a new interest in Marxism as a heir of 19th century optimistic doctrines, ultimately optimistic. All this kind of thing. I think that the great vogue of Teilhard de Chardin also reflects this, because Teilhard is in many ways the last of the 19th century theologians who still can believe in a kind of undialectical progress of the world getting better and better, and so on. So I think that this attempt to sort of post-crisis theology, to move back and recover some of the themes of hope and progress of the 19th century, reflect this kind of crisis within crisis theology and within the general feeling of hope within modern society in general. Now, a man like Moltmann, then I think belongs to this kind of school, who is recovering some of the themes of 19th century theology, and particularly by way of Marxist humanism, but he's also recovering it as a man who is sort of post-crisis theology. In other words, you have a kind of reciprocal relationship here. He is recovering themes of progress, but he is not recovering them the way a 19th century man would, you see. I mean, he has passed through all of the critique of crisis theology, and so he recovers those themes of progress with all the sort of chastening that has taken place as a result of the 20th century historical experience and its theological critique. So he recovers a kind of chastened 19th century theology, which has passed through this kind of criticism. But also, I think that the demand for a theology of hope operates as a kind of critique of the negativism and limitations of crisis theology. And as we go on today, I hope to show you how he tries to criticized some of the limitations of crisis theology, and particularly the left-wing theologians, crisis theologians such as Bultmann and Gogarten, the existentialist theologians. He's very critical of them. So you get a kind of reciprocal criticism here, a criticism of existentialist theology by way of an insistence on a more meaningful concept of history, but also a criticism of doctrines of progress, which has come out of crisis theology itself. Okay, now he starts out at the beginning of his book, The Theology of Hope, by distinguishing between the God of Revelation and the God of Epiphanies. And what does Epiphanies mean? And Epiphanies mean a kind of a appearance of God from heaven, you know, so a kind of eternal shining forth of God out of the heavens, kind of a rainbow type of God who comes down and hallows the present moment. And he says that the God of Revelation must be constantly distinguished between the God of Epiphanies. And he thinks that essentially the pagan gods, the Hellenistic understanding of God and so on, was a God of Epiphany, a God of a revelation of the eternal within the present moment, but a kind of revelation of the eternal within the present moment that carried no historical dynamic itself, but it tended just to sort of negate history. History was sort of suspended and God was revealed from heaven, but there was no kind of mandate laid upon history itself. So the gods of Epiphanies were gods who disclosed an eternal heaven above. They disclosed a realm of perfect being above with which man could sort of commune through a kind of ecstasy which suspended time. The God of Revelation, by contrast, is not a God of Epiphanies, but rather he is a God of promise. He is a God of demand. And this promise refers men, it doesn't sort of suspend man in an ecstasy in the present moment, but the God of promise points man forward. He points man forward to a new world to come, a new world which does not yet exist, but is yet to come. That's the difference between the God of promise and the God of Epiphanies. So the effect of revelation, the effect of revelation in the Bible is not to create a kind of moment of harmony between heaven and earth, you know, kind of suspended there, a kind of static thing, a kind of harmony of reconciled being between heaven and earth, but rather the effect of revelation is to shatter a false harmony, to shatter, you might say, a pseudo-law and order, and to reveal the incongruity between the present world and God's demand. That's what the God of Revelation does. Of course, here Bultmann is coming out of crisis theology. So revelation does not sort of harmonize man with the present world, but rather it sets man against the present conditions and points him forward to a new world to come. It sort of drags him out of Egypt and sets him on the road to the promised land. And the image of Exodus, I think, is kind of the key image for Moltmann's theology. In fact, I think that really Exodus, he does better with Exodus than he does with the death and resurrection. He can really swing with Exodus. And a great deal of his book is really an analysis of, you know, Old Testament theology. Now, Moltmann insists that in this sort of tension between the present world and the promise, we cannot make a sharp distinction between the Old and New Testament. In other words, you can't say the Old Testament is the promise and the New Testament is the fulfillment of the promise. That is not the case. But rather, the tension between the present and the promise runs right through the Old and the New Testaments. And I think he's correct here. And we can talk more about that. Both the whole of the Bible, Old and New Testament, is a religion of future promise. And its effect is not to harmonize man with the present, but rather to keep man unreconciled with the present world in a state of movement, in a state of movement toward a world to come. Now, Moltmann then goes on to insist that this is just as true of the revelation in Jesus Christ as it is of the revelation in Moses, that revelation in Jesus Christ as well as that to Moses is not a fulfillment. The revelation in Jesus Christ is not its own self-fulfillment, but rather the revelation in Jesus Christ points forward to a coming which is still in the future. And this is, of course, this neglected symbol in Christian theology of the coming, which is probably somewhat incorrectly called the second coming. So the revelation in Jesus Christ, just as that in Moses, points forward to a coming still, which is still in the future. The effect of the whole of the biblical revelation, Old and New Testament, is to expose the incongruity between God's demand and man's present existence, so that man is drawn out of where he is and strikes out for a promised land. Now, Moltmann then goes on to define God's being, and this is a definition I think he's taken very much from the Marxist humanist. He goes on to define God's being in terms of this future of man. That man's being is that of the one who is not yet. And this is the way Garadi defined it too. That man is the one who is not yet. He has not yet become what he is called to be. But rather he lives out of this exigency, which was Garadi's term. He lives out of this demand to become what he is not yet and has never been. In other words, I think that he tends to sort of negate the idea that way back at some point in the garden or something, man had this and lost it. Rather, man is called to be what he is not yet and has never been. And the existence of God lies in this not yet of man's being. In other words, the reality of God does not lie in some sort of realm above the world or behind the world, but rather the reality of God lies in a realm ahead of the world. It lies in the future of a world which is not yet present, but is to come. However, this being of God as man's future, this being of God as the future of man, is not merely an absence, but rather it is a power which sort of comes to man from the future, pulling man out from where he is and setting his feet on the road to new possibilities. This is the model which you have constantly in Moltmann. As I said, the Exodus tends to be his most central symbol here. The Israelites called out of Egypt and on their way into the desert to the Promised Land represent man who is living out of this call of God. But the resurrection of Jesus does not bring this exigency to an end, in the sense that the new messianic age now becomes present. And all you have to do is look around at the world and you know the messianic age isn't present. There's a famous story of a rabbi, probably apocryphal. I think it comes out of Jewish tradition. At least I know a Jewish Talmud scholar told me of a rabbi sitting in his upper room with his disciples, and somebody announced to him that the Christ has come, and he looks down and he sees the Roman soldiers marching along, you know, occupying Israel, and he says, in effect, "Who are you kidding?" The Messianic age is not yet present. So the resurrection of Jesus from the dead does not bring this demand to an end in the sense that the Messianic age already became present, and therefore can become a kind of a hallowed fulfillment in the past to which we can refer ourselves. But rather, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead is the ultimate sort of pointer forward. It is the ultimate sort of pointer away from itself to the final fulfillment in the future. The risen Lord is he who is to come. That's the kind of paradox of the risen Lord. The risen Lord, as an experience in the past, points away from that experience to its ultimate fulfillment in the future. The risen Lord is he who is to come. He is the Messiah, the Lord of the future world. His resurrection, then, is a proleptic manifestation of this future world.
What is proleptic?
And proleptic is like a little kid 3 weeks before Christmas experiencing Christmas by way of anticipation. That's what proleptic means, to experience something in advance of its actual happening. And that's the way he understands the resurrection, that the resurrection is a proleptic experience, a manifestation of this future coming, rather than a completion of it. It's a sort of a preview of things to come, so to speak. So the parousia of Christ, that is his coming as Lord of the future world, which is the theme which with which we end our creed, of course, and it's very clear that that hasn't come yet. This parousia of Christ as Lord of the future world comes not in order to unveil what has already completely happened in the past, which is the way Barth understands the parousia of Christ, but rather the parousia of Christ is the final happening of that which was foreshown in Jesus Christ. That's the way Motman interprets it. That's a very different kind of interpretation. And this final coming of Christ is the fulfillment of that promise which was given to Moses and which was proleptically experienced in the Christ event. And I think this, you know, of course, brings Christianity and Judaism a lot closer together, which may be a kind of an interesting thing ecumenically. Okay, that's why he interprets the biblical theology of promise as a theology of promise throughout. He then goes on to talk about the way man lives out of this promise. And here he talks about the way man lives out of this promise as a kind of moving horizon, which I find kind of nice. I think if you're a hiker, you can understand very well this the idea of a moving horizon, because you know that you want to get to a certain place for lunch, you know, and that becomes kind of your goal. That becomes, you know, this. The kingdom is when you get to that place for lunch. But when you get to that place for lunch, of course, then that just becomes a moment which then sort of points you forward to your next goal, which was to get to that lake by 3 o'clock in the afternoon and so on. So you get to this kind of moving horizon, which is the way man lives out of this call of God. Now, in this moving horizon, you have the relative horizons, which are the ones that you are conscious of. You're conscious of getting to the place for lunch, and you're conscious of getting to the lake by 3 o'clock and so on. So the relative horizon, but beyond that relative horizon, there is sort of the ultimate horizon. The ultimate horizon of perfect fulfillment, when all of man's hopes, the whole world is transfigured, you know, all of that complete perfection, which is the ultimate horizon that's symbolized by the idea of the kingdom of God. So the idea of the kingdom of God is the symbol for the ultimate horizon, the ultimate fulfillment of man, in which, you know, everything really comes together the way it's supposed to be, to use the title of a little book. That's the way it's supposed to be, you know, that's the kingdom of God. So that constitutes the ultimate horizon, but we can't point ourselves toward that ultimate horizon, because that's too much, you know. So we can only point ourselves toward the relative horizons, and the ultimate horizon sort of invests the relative horizon with its power. That the relative horizon, let's say, of in the 19th century, it was achieving justice for the working man. In the 20th century, perhaps it's achieving racial justice and the abolition of war and so on. That these relative horizons sort of become our concrete symbols of the goal of perfection, that the ultimate horizon sort of shines down and illuminates that relative horizon, and all of our strivings for perfection becomes concentrated, so to speak, on that particular goal. If you've ever, if you remember the sermons of Martin Luther King, I trust some of you heard those sermons. You remember that one of the things that he did so powerfully was to take this relative goal of racial justice in America and kind of invest it with all of these biblical symbols of the promise of the kingdom of God, where he talked about, you know, let justice roll down like waters, you know, and we shall walk hand in hand, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh will see it together, and so forth. And he took all of this biblical symbolism of the kingdom of God and invested it in this particular goal. Of racial justice in America, and I think that is appropriate. You know, that is biblically appropriate. that our particular goals become our concrete expressions of our striving for the kingdom of God. However, while recognizing that the particular goal becomes our concrete symbol for our striving for the kingdom of God, we have to at the same time differentiate that particular goal from the ultimate horizon. The ultimate horizon of perfection of the kingdom invests the particular goal with power, but it always remains beyond it. And so when we get to that particular goal, then we can recognize that this really isn't completely it, that this really is only partial, that this too is ambivalent, and the ultimate horizon of the kingdom of God sort of moves out from beyond that and directs us beyond that particular goal to something more and something more and something more and so on. So you get a kind of double thing here of the relative horizon, the ultimate horizon, the relative horizon investing the relative horizon with power to pull us forward, but then when we sort of get close to it, it moves on, keeps us from staying there, and directs us toward new goals beyond that. And this is, you know, this is the way you live historically, Moltmann feels. And it's really a very hard lesson to learn. I mean, it may sound sort of simple when you talk about it in the abstract, but it's really a very hard lesson to learn how to live historically in that way. Because when you invest all your goodies, all of your dreams, all your aspirations in achieving a certain thing, and then you begin to get close to it, it's very hard to recognize the limitations of that goal and to engage in a critique of it, and to recognize that there's a further goal beyond that. I think that there's very few people who can have more than one goal in one lifetime. And in many cases, a whole civilization can only have kind of one goal. And the breakup of that civilization comes when a new goal presents itself and that civilization is unable to criticize itself and relativize its own aspirations and move on to a new goal.
Rosemary?
Yeah?
That sounds awful. Like, well, you don't relativize it until you get it. It sounds like never-ending fanaticism.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with Moltmann, is that, and also with Bultmann too, is that you get this kind of discouraging on and on and onness, you know. And
well,
I think
I'm
that
not
he's
thinking just about the discouragement of the seeker, but I'm concerned what the fanatic is going to do to other people. Meanwhile,
yeah,
he
well,
doesn't recognize the relativity of his goal until he gets it. Meanwhile, who dies?
Yeah, well, this is the thing that I think is very difficult, because in a certain sense, you in order to believe in it, you have to kind of see it as the concrete expression of the kingdom. And it's very hard to believe in it enough to strive for it and then sort of simultaneously relativize it. I mean, it's very hard to do both of those things simultaneously. I mean, psychologically, I don't know how you get this together. And I see this in terms of, you know, practically every revolutionary history, that it's really difficult to do both things. If you're really going to be enough of a believer to strive for that, you've got to almost you have to almost kind of invest in it, your hopes in it, in a rather uncritical way. And as soon as you begin to see this as only ambivalent, then somehow the nerve of striving for it ceases. See what I mean? I mean, I think that you get, for example, later on I like to talk about the Marxist humanists in Eastern Europe who have gone through a critique of Marxist future hope, where they now see all the ambivalence and so on. And you can see the tremendous truth of their criticism. You know, they've really seen this relativity. But at the same time, practically all the excitement of striving for a new world is gone. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's really hard to do both things psychologically. I just don't know whether people are capable of doing it.
As you're using the word hope here, it's not being used in this way that St. Paul does. And he anticipates the hope. He uses it in terms of the future kingdom, not the earthly kingdom. It's always in connection with the future kingdom, whereas the theologians you're talking about here are thinking in terms of the kingdom of God here on earth.
Well, they're doing something a little bit more complex than that. They're talking about man's hope for a future kingdom, as being the way in which he experiences a movement forward in history. And I think that one of the things that we ought to criticize is this kind of either-or between a heavenly kingdom and a historical existence, because that's exactly what I think Marxists have very properly criticized Christianity for, you see, is that its hopes became purely otherworldly and therefore became irrelevant to our existence on earth.
Isn't that sort of our theology, though?
Pardon me?
Isn't that sort of our theology, though?
Well, but maybe it's bad theology.
Yeah, but
and it's certainly not Old Testament theology.
Yeah, but suppose we live in New Testament theology.
Well, there's some peculiar reason why Christianity did not throw away the Old Testament, which I think we better figure out. The point is that Christianity did feel that the Old Testament was a part of its gospel. You have to remember that for the first century of Christianity, Christianity had no New Testament. Its Bible was the Old Testament, and it was out of the Bible that it read the gospel. So the New Testament times, you know, those apostolic times we're talking about, they were not standing up there reading St. Paul and the gospel. They didn't have any St. Paul and the gospel. They read the Old Testament.
That's what we're doing.
What?
Our problem may be that that is what we're doing.
Yeah, we should. So I think what Moltmann is trying to do is to show the continuity of this theology of progress throughout. Well, I mean, I gave the great goal of socialism and so on, which I think is still with us, was to grapple with the dehumanization of technological civilization, industrial civilization, and the immediate thing that it revealed itself was this incredible dehumanization of the working man. And I think we've partially overcome that in the West, but we haven't necessarily at all overcome a lot of the larger problems that they were also grappling with. So this is certainly a kind of goal. It's pretty hard to look around pick up the paper and hear about the great fortress of missiles and counter missiles and chemical and biological warfare. I mean, it looks pretty apocalyptic in a negative sense, you know, that man is embarked on an incredibly sort of self-destructive course. To the point where the idea that we can get a little bit better bit by bit almost is disappearing. That's why I think there's kind of apocalyptic theologies coming into play right now, because things have gotten so bad that people really are not at all sure that things can get better bit by bit, you know, that they almost feel that something has gone so radically bad with modern civilization that you'd almost have to kind of overthrow the whole thing at the root. And there's almost, I think with apocalypticism in general, there's a tendency to get into a kind of primitivism where you almost would prefer to be back in the cave than to be in this kind of civilization. I think that's what a lot of this kind of communalism, if you look up on the board in the dining room, a lot of the youth who have engaged in a very deep critique of this kind of civilization, they're completely turned off by modern civilization and its war and its commercialism and its whole way of life. And in effect, what they're finally doing is retreating to a kind of Stone Age and waiting rather consciously for the bomb. You see, I mean, this comes out very much when you read the kind of things that are being said by people who are moving into rural communes, that they really kind of expect the Holocaust. They expect the total devastation, and they're getting ready to survive. Now, this kind of thing, in one way, is pessimism, but on the other hand, it denotes a kind of apocalypticism that supposes that perhaps things will be better if we could just destroy the whole thing. And I think some of the sort of excitement about the idea that California might split off and float off to the Pacific, yeah, you know, there is, yeah. Wow, that's going to be great. Or that there might be another earthquake in San Francisco. I think that the almost optimistic looking forward to this disaster, which you've got in California, also points to the feeling that man has just messed it up so badly that he can't solve it anymore. And only some kind of great natural disaster can return man to where he ought to be, where he can kind of start over in a simple way.
How is the moment I try to listen to him?
You have to put on a mask and creep in.
I sound like I'm in a cave. I was wondering how presumably a development of human progress to the point of a kingdom of God on earth that is going to finally progress to more improvement.
Yeah, well, I think that what you get in Moltmann is an attempt to get more back to a kind of a progressive concept. He's very critical of the romantic utopians.
Yeah.
And that comes out primarily in the way he attacks Bultmann and the existentialists, that he feels that you got in existentialism a kind of product of romanticism, utopian romanticism, that tended to make a dichotomy between man's personal community and institutions. Everything institutional, everything objective becomes sort of bad, dehumanizing, enslaving, you see. And so you get this kind of dichotomy between community and institution. And that's a very deep and prevalent kind of dichotomy. I mean, every time I talk to, you know, sort of church reforming type Christians, you get this type of dichotomy. They want to get away from institutions, get to community, and so forth. And he feels that this kind of dichotomy comes out of a romantic reaction to technological civilization, which created really a kind of a new body-soul dualism, where you could only live in a kind of moment of personal relationship or a moment of inwardness or something like that. And this was always posed over against anything objective, anything institutional, really anything historical. It was an ahistorical kind of salvation. So he attacks Bultmann for this, and I think by implication he attacks utopian romanticism in general, and instead tries to opt for a kind of synthesis in which you don't opt out of institutions, but you humanize institutions. You struggle to make the structure a place where community happens. You know, this kind of bringing together of the two, which is the only, which the way he feels is genuine historical creation. That you and I think he's right there. Now, the trouble with Moltmann is, in terms of this book, is he doesn't go much farther than that. The whole thing remains very abstract and very kind of symbolic and very, you know, drawing nice symbols from the Old Testament and stuff like that. And you need a kind of a second book to go on and really say what this means, you know, sociologically.
One honest person.
No, he doesn't. What he has is this kind of. I think that what he has is constantly this kind of double relative ultimate horizon relationship, where the ultimate horizon always remains transcendent, investing the relative horizon with power to focus us forward to really create real.
So you're always relating to God and or to.
No, you really relate to the relative horizon because that becomes your concrete. You relate to your concrete goals because that's the only thing you can relate to, you see. Yeah, you relate to your concrete goals because that becomes, that's where you live as a finite person, and that becomes your concrete experience of God, you see. And so there is a kind of relative fulfillment there and a relative experience of God where you are in your immediate aspirations and struggle. That becomes, you know, your immediate thing. But the ultimate stands behind that, giving it power, but also preventing it from being a kind of a static, sacral thing that's going to just become the end in itself. That never is allowed to just become God. It becomes your relative experience of God, and then drawing you out from that to new relative experiences with this ultimate horizon always beyond it. And then somehow back of that, there's the assumption that this has power because it will ultimately come. I mean, he has a kind of literalism as the final point of reference, which he never explains at all.
No.
He never explains at all how that is possible.
Is that the afterlife?
That's when the whole of history and God finally come together. It's not a God that negates history, but it's the whole thing finally really comes together in the end.
Is there a person, does he conceive of God as more of a concept than a personal way that something...
Well, he talks about, you know, he has these kind of symbols. God is the one who calls you. I mean, so this is a very personal kind of thing. The calling one, the one, the God of promise. He's the ultimate dimension of man's future aspirations and so on. But what he specifically negates about God is the idea of being. You know, is logos theology and being, that the idea that God is the primal being who is already kind of set up and fixes all the possibilities is the God which he rejects. Because this again, of course, he's sort of accepting the Marxist critique here. This is a static concept of God, whereas the biblical God is the God who is not defined just by what already exists, but by constant new possibilities of things which do not yet exist. So God goes beyond being because he goes beyond what presently exists.
Could you say
to a future world which does not yet exist. Oh. And so the sort of primal, the primal symbols of that creation where man was already made it and then fell, and that primal God really kind of disappeared. What you have is sort of a experimental world in which the fulfillment goals are all in the future.
Could you say, Rosemary, that part of the distinction would be rather than having a static God who stands above history, that really what Moltmann is opting for is a God who is more or less in the future or at the end of history and operates from that?
Yeah, and there's the kind of confusion is that when we say God is not or God is not yet or something, this just sounds like a negativity, kind of like an absence, whereas Moltmann's concept of God as the future of man is a power which operates in history, but from a base that's sort of hard to conceive of.
we meet God more at the kind of the tip of our fingers as we move forward, rather
than
the kind of the scholastic substantial.
Yeah, and the classical sort of the God of classical philosophy really sort of stood as this completed structure of being in the beginning, which sent out his logos, which was kind of the master plan of the world, and everything was kind of set up from the focus of primal being.
Does he take an awful lot of this from von Rad in his theology, where he...
Well, I think, yeah, he's got...
The dichotomy between, you know, the promise is given, but it's not described, and then the fulfillment comes, and it's in the future, and there's an anticipation to it, but it's not the kind of anticipation which gives you a very clear idea of what's...
The anticipation can only be made concrete by the relative horizon. That's where you get the sort of concrete symbols but the concrete symbols never exhaust the fulfillment.
It's never an adequate expression. There's a sense of mystery that continues on.
Yeah, but I think it's important to get both things going, because unless you take seriously the relative symbols of this aspiration, then the whole thing becomes kind of empty and vague and has no concrete historical power. And he's very concerned that this thing does operate concretely and have historical power.
Isn't this one of the basic criticisms of Moltmann, that although he tries to concretize it, it really doesn't pull off?
Well, I think that you have the basis in his thinking with his concept of the moving horizon for concreteness, but because he keeps it all in these kind of vague symbols, and I mean, he needs some, you know, some more real sociology working there to give it a kind of modern concreteness.
Rosemary.
But I think there's a basis there for it.
I'm just kind of trying this on for size. Let's say that I'm Paul Getty, and my present relative horizon is completely fell from horizon to horizon with oil wells. What does this mean for my greater horizon? I'll be pumping oil for all eternity or something?
I think that God's promise would probably come quite quickly as a way of leaving behind those oil wells as your most immediate Egypt, and pointing you forward to some more authentic promise.
Mm. But you do think that this is a
because
valid,
you do have this idea. You
this
see,
this is a valid horizon.
No, I'm not. You have to get this other thing is that you only get that sense of promise out of a crisis with what you are. You see, I mean that's the immediate standpoint. I mean this promise, this demand comes to you, not in order to immediately validate what you think you want right now, but really to immediately it starts out by setting you in crisis with where you are right now.
Seems to amuse me, that's the moment of truth.
As we study Exodus, going back to what you said about Exodus, there the emphasis is on the redeeming God as a type of the Messiah to come and the fulfillment. Now, from what you've said, I don't see much of that in this theology of Mothman.
Yeah, well, he's really, I mean, his kind of dichotomy between the God of Revelation and the God of Epiphanies is a little disturbing because it does seem to remove a sense of reconciliation in the present.
And the redemption?
Because this redemption is always a way of setting you in crisis with the present and in a sort of a aspirational relationship to a new crisis, that's right, to a new demand. I mean, you can see this in terms of social goals very, very clearly. Let's say in terms of racial justice. In order to strive for racial justice as our immediate horizon of achieving God's demand, we have to be set in crisis with our concrete life. We have to be set in crisis with the suburbia in which we live or whatever, the whole kind of immediate social privilege that we have in this society just because we walk around in white skins and so forth. And this goes very deep. It's not a superficial thing at all. So we are set in crisis with just a tremendous amount of the concrete advantages we enjoy. We have to undergo a tremendous critique of ourselves. We have to decide perhaps a number of things we have to leave behind. We might have to lose a lot of friends. We might have to lose a lot of things in order to really receive this demand. So we are set in crisis with our present social structure, with our present social life, in order to hear this demand, and we are pointed forward to the goal of racial justice. So there's crisis and with ourselves and a pointing forward to a particular goal which becomes sort of invested with the power of God's demand. This is the way, you know, the kingdom operates concretely, but then, you know, this in itself is not the final kingdom, you say there.
No, this was the struggle of the prophets. Most of the prophets before the exile struggled with this idea of justice and righteousness, man to man, as an expression then of their faith in God. And so we're struggling with the same thing they did at that time. That's what brought about the exile and so on. And this is the struggle we're in today in the same way.